Today, some more thoughts about civility in armed civilization.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
We introduced the topic last time. I will jump past where we were and not try to repeat the entire thing to get down to the current point. The idea was that in the wake of some mass shootings recently, including a couple that have been closer to me, I've heard a lot of people talking about what they consider common sense responses, common sense gun reform in response to the problem that mass shootings have become. And we talked about the need to re-examine what common sense and obvious problems mean and make sure that we're being considerate about it. And again, if you haven't heard it, I would encourage you to go back and listen to the first part of this because it does frame a lot of where I'm going. And I'm going to try not to rehash all of those nuances, or they're not really nuanced, but they might seem nuanced or caveats in that part of the discussion. But anyway, we talked about that, just what we're, why we're bringing it up as something that needs to be addressed. And then we talked about the appropriate response in light of what we're actually talking about, mass shootings of some kind and the high-capacity weapons that can be used to bring them about. And so in the wake of all of that, what I was headed toward was a conversation about what people have labeled as common sense gun reform. And that, in some ways, reduces to just three ingredients, one of which is red flag laws, which honestly, I don't know. I will talk about what the objections are to in a moment, but which honestly, I'm not hearing a lot of objection to. It makes a lot of sense to pass these red flag laws, and there is still resistance at the legislative level. And so I'll pause briefly to say what I don't want to spend the entire time on at all today, because it would keep us from the main topic. But I do want to mention this, that it's almost to the point where this seems like something along the lines of immigration in our political setting. Meaning there are, I know because I have talked to them, or and when I say in the same room, I mean in the same Zoom room, because it was during COVID that I had some of these conversations, but I've been in the same Zoom room with Democrats and Republicans who were on the far extremes of their party's representation of the issue of immigration. But when they're in the room talking about it, know that common sense solutions would work here, that talking about legitimate solutions for immigration could effect real change, but it would kill their fundraising. And they don't say this, but what happens is they talk rationally about it, and then when they go back to the legislative session or they go back to their own constituencies, they end up falling back on the same divisive rhetoric or inaction that keeps immigration as a policy topic instead of an issue to be resolved, or instead of considering the human beings that are being affected by it. And at the point where people are able to talk rationally about things like red flag laws, which I'll talk in slightly more detail about it in just a moment. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it'll be enough to catch you up on it. But when people can talk rationally about it, politicians can talk rationally about it, but then can never come to an agreement to go ahead and do it, then there is an underlying suspicion, I think justified by decades of experience, that says they just don't want to lose the political bait for the water. They don't want to lose the chum, you know, for the political waters that allows them to raise money by saying, we're not going to give away your gun rights. We're not going to do even red flag laws. And that's a tragedy when people die because of inaction about it. So anyway, part of it, I think, has to be just political grandstanding, because it's not really that difficult to enact something like a red flag law. So that's the first one that I want to mention. The others will be background checks and then bans on semi-automatic assault weapons or on high-capacity magazines or both. But it's just sort of a limitation on the capacity of the weapons that we're willing to sell in our gun stores. So the red flag laws issue, let's just get them on the table for a moment. The red flag laws issue seems fairly simple. I mean, the opposition to it comes in the form that opposition to any kind of new restriction brings. And it's a legitimate question that ought to be raised, which is this going to threaten my privacy? Is this going to threaten my liberty? And it does create the potential for some violations. A red flag law is the idea that if somebody has certain red flags that could be attached to them, mental health issues in some cases, which raises legitimate concerns for people who are in the mental health care industry to say, well, why are you labeling all mental health care patients as if they're a threat to society? It creates an undue burden on those individuals who are not a violent threat to society. Fair. That's a fair objection here, and terms would need to be defined so that it wasn't some kind of blanket action against anybody who seeks mental health care. Because if you do that, if you just created some blanket action where you say, well, if you're under mental health care, you can't get a gun, then people who need mental health care will not go get it because they won't want to go on that list. So obviously we don't want to do that. So there are rational concerns that ought to be raised, which would then help shape the form of red flag laws. Those are not obscure. People are aware. These are in the conversation. So we are capable of doing that and preserving our privacy and liberty. It's also true that somebody with a grudge could call in the same way that people SWAT someone. If you haven't heard it, I think you can look it up. Isn't that what it's called? SWATting? So in the same way that can happen, this could happen, that people could call and say, oh, I heard about so-and-so and seems like they're just ranting and raving and they might, so don't let them buy a gun. And then suddenly you find yourself on a red flag list. That's a legitimate concern. But again, the fact that people can abuse it doesn't mean we shouldn't have it in place. And it should be the case that if you knew that your son or daughter or husband or wife or parent or stranger down the street or whatever was threatening to go off the rails and kill everybody at work or something, it makes sense that if you reported that, that there would be a flag that would go up and say, oh, well, this person can't buy a firearm for the time being. We'll do some investigation and find out whether it's the case. I understand that costs resources. It costs time and money, but not doing it costs what we have now. And obviously, we would need to do it. And again, I really hear most people saying, yeah, this makes sense. Let's get this done. Even among fairly conservative people, I hear them saying, let's get this done. So, you know, it's not perfect. It does have some issues with it, but this particular one is an avenue for disarming imminent threats before the damage is done. Again, it's not making them a criminal before the damage is done. I'm not saying prosecute them, put them in jail before they've done anything wrong. We're not talking about, you know, weird future prognostications like that. We're just saying let's disarm a situation before there are people who are victims of murder in this case. So, and I get it that also there are plenty of people who don't have any indicators that they're going to do something like this, and a red flag law would not keep them from being able to do what they did. I get that, but there are some who do. There are some who do have indicators that something's going wrong and that shouldn't be able to buy a gun, and this would help with them. So red flag laws, that's an easy one to talk about. Background checks. You say, well, people, I mean, if you bought a gun, you know that there are background checks. I've bought a gun, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. One time, I have bought a gun. I have more than one gun. I've had guns given to me my entire life because I grew up in Texas and because I have friends from West Virginia. That's not a slight on either state. I'm just saying it's part of the culture in those two states. And so anyway, my point is, so when I bought a gun, I know. I mean, I had to do all the background stuff. I had to fill out all the forms, and I bought it from a licensed dealer. It was a guy that I knew, but he is a licensed dealer. And so I bought it from him, and I had to fill out all the forms, do everything legal to make it happen, so on, no problem. And then I finally got the guns. Quite an ordeal to go through. But supposedly at a gun show, you don't have to do the background check. And I can understand why that was set up, because the inconvenience and the impossibility of doing these massive convention-style gun shows, if you were going to do a gun show and for every sale you had to set up some kind of background check system, blah, 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 I get that would be really difficult. And yet, doesn't it seem obvious that we should do it? And that if it meant we couldn't have the gun shows, that we probably shouldn't have the gun shows, or that we at least shouldn't allow sales at the gun shows, or that we should have a greater level of enforcement against sales at gun shows if they can't do background checks. And because it's not hard to figure out that if you want to buy a gun but can't get one because you can't pass a background check, that then you probably shouldn't be able to buy a gun when you go to a gun show. And yet no one's going to be able to figure that out if we're not doing background checks at gun shows. I've not ever gone to a gun show. I don't know what it's like when people are buying guns there. I don't know if somebody's standing in the corner and saying, you can't sell him a gun, he hasn't. I don't know. All I know is right now, one of the ways people are talking about being able to put up some screens so that people who shouldn't be armed to carry out acts that are going to harm other people is by doing background checks at gun shows. And it makes sense to me that we would do that, even though it will cost the industry some money, obviously. And basically all that means is it's going to cost people more money to buy a gun. Okay. It's going to cost more money to buy a gun. That's okay. I don't know anybody who's not going to buy a gun just because it costs more money. So there's one, background checks at gun shows. And then finally, a ban on semi-automatic assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And I know, I get it, that this feels like we're losing our Second Amendment rights. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. But it is a very specific kind of ban or restriction. For instance, as I understand it, and I may have misunderstood this, I just heard it in the news, on the news in passing from the radio. The implication was that a bill had gotten at least one step forward on raising the age in Texas, on raising the age for people to be able to buy assault-style weapons from 18 to 21. I may have misunderstood what they were saying on the radio. Do not quote me on this. I do not have the original source on it. But that would be an example of what I'm talking about. That's some restriction on semi-automatic assault-style weapons or on high-capacity magazines. This one does make sense to me. It is, I get how fun it is to go to a target range, a gun range, and unload an entire magazine into a target. I understand how people experience that, and I understand that it's just sort of, like on July 4th, firing firecrackers, and hearing explosions and all that kind of stuff. I get it. And I also get the fun of feeling like you have control over something with that kind of power. I understand why people do that. But I also know, even when people hunt, there are restrictions on how many shells you can have in your shotgun if you're duck hunting or if you're dove hunting or whatever. I don't hunt, not often anyway, and I don't remember all those restrictions, but I know they're there. If you get found by a game warden and you've got 5 shells instead of 3 in the shotgun while you're hunting dove or ducks or whatever it is, then you're in trouble. You have violated a rule. And it just seems like if we're doing that for hunting, when you are there to kill the animals, that we could at least say to people, we're going to limit the capacity that you have for using your gun. It just I don't understand why we would worry about that one. Although I will talk more about that in just a moment. Again, I'm just trying to introduce the concepts right now and the basic ideas that people are giving out. There are at least 10 states where right now, where there are limitations on buying assault weapons. And I'll come back and talk more about that one in just a second. So those are the common sense gun reforms that most people are talking about. Red flag laws, background checks at gun shows, and then some kind of ban on these high-capacity weapons. I will say there was another one a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago now. There was another one that people were talking about pretty extensively, and it was the idea of buying back weapons from people. So let's get guns off the street by offering cash to people who have the guns. And, you know, the implication, by the way, being that the greatest threat would be from people who would want the money in that moment. So it's basically aiming at poorer people who own the guns. But that's a conversation for a different day. The point is that that one wasn't very well received. And you'll remember, and it did take a certain form that's not going to be well received in American culture, when Beto O'Rourke talked about that idea. We're going to have a mandatory buyback of assault weapons, that kind of thing. A mandatory anything is just the wrong language to use, however you're going to describe it in American society. But there are places where that has worked and where buybacks have worked, but that doesn't seem to be on the table in people's minds right now as a legitimate offer or a legitimate solution for right now. So we'll leave that one off the table for the moment. Okay, so with that kind of solution in mind, we should talk about why this is such an impossible conversation for people to have in terms of the specifics of the arguments that people use. I know a lot of these arguments because I've made a lot of these arguments. I held a lot of these positions more in defense of liberty than anything else. And I just want to be a little more well-rounded about it, because obviously, and if you didn't get this in the first episode hearing it, I'll say it again, I agree with people who are saying enough is enough. I mean, come on. There should be enough inductive evidence, enough repetition of these specific kinds of instances in our society with these specific types of weapons that we should be able to say, let's do something to stop this from our side, from society's side. Let's do something to prevent it from happening. And if you say, well, yeah, I'm willing to do something, but I'm not willing to make it anything about weapons at all, then you're not coming at it with a willingness to listen to reasonable people who are saying, we don't have to take every weapon away from everyone, but there may be a way that having fewer of these weapons in fewer hands could help. And it's really hard to understand how that couldn't help. Doesn't mean we have to pass the law, but it does mean we should be willing to have a little more honest conversation about it with people who think differently about it than we have in the past. So I'll just take some of the phrases that I think characterize or maybe caricature, but they only caricature it honestly because these were rhetorical arguments that have been made historically by the NRA and other organizations who advocate on the other side of this question about guns. And so I'll use those phrases as sort of a launching pad for each one of these and just do maybe two or three or four of them. So here's one general objection to the idea of restricting guns in any way whatsoever. And it is the obvious one. Guns don't kill people, people kill people, right? Guns don't kill people, people do. Been a popular saying for decades, as long as I've been alive, I've heard that saying. It found its footing around 1910, the first decade of the 20th century, which was a surprise to me because I wasn't alive back then. Of course, I didn't know it, but as it turns out, it's been around that long. The NRA obviously relied heavily on it for a long time. In the mid-20th century, I haven't heard them express it lately, but it might be out there with them still. But the idea, to hear it more precisely, this one's not super complicated to deal with. It's true in this sense. Guns are not sufficient to commit murder. A gun sitting on a table doesn't murder someone. That's true. It doesn't happen, at least not often. Guns are not sufficient to be the cause of a murder. That is, they are not the cause of these murders. But very few things in life have a singular cause. In fact, the philosopher on me, who's not drowning right this moment, wants to come back to it and say, well, yeah, in Aristotle's world, everything has at least four, or in reality six, causes to it, including formal and material cause, and then the causes that have to do with actually bringing it to pass, so some kind of efficient and final cause. So, I mean, as a philosopher, it's obvious that nothing has a singular cause, but in this case, I'm going beyond that and saying, I mean, it is true that the gun may not be sufficient to cause a murder by itself, but it is the case that guns are a necessary part of a necessary cause in a lot of murders, not all of them. And it's not true that they would always be necessary, but in some cases, if there had not been a gun, there simply would not have been a murder. And the reason for that's pretty obvious. It's the reason guns are so popular among people who want to have them, because they empower us in a way that other things don't empower us. It's the reason that if I said to you, we want to take all your guns, but it's okay, we'll give you knives in their place, that you would say, I don't want knives, I want my gun. You want your gun for the same reason that gun is necessary to the perpetration of some of these crimes. That's just the way it is. That's why guns have this special role. And that makes them necessary to the commission of some of these crimes. So because guns can give some people, not everyone, but some people, the ability to do what they could not do with a knife or wouldn't be willing to do with a car, they end up being necessary to some deaths, which means it's reasonable to have a conversation about whether restricting the access to some guns in some situations might be helpful in dealing with this issue. So there's one general objection and an initial response to it. To get the conversation started and to admit that there needs to be a real conversation had about it. If for instance, we said, well, you know, there are no mass murders without guns, we know that's false. There are mass murders without guns. It can happen. It happens with machetes. It happens with cars. It happens with knives. But it doesn't happen the way it happens with an AR-15, for instance. And we all know that. We know the difference. That's why an assault rifle is what it is. So saying on both sides of that, yeah, okay, I hear you. It's not the only cause of mass murder, but it could make a difference in these mass murders. And these are a significant proportion of what's going on in our society right now. And so we need to have that conversation. That's the guns don't kill people, people do thing. The second objection that people raise to any kind of restrictions at all is to say, if you make guns illegal, only criminals will have them. I remember this line coming out of, I think, the NRA. It may have been someone else. If you make guns illegal, only criminals will have them. Okay, well, I mean, I understand the point being made. Well, we don't want only criminals to be armed. There's a double kind of rhetoric going on there that I don't even want to get into right now, because I would get bogged down in it and I would enjoy it too much, and I'm not sure it would go anywhere meaningful. But, you know, the backside of this is just to use that same rationale with other kinds of mass destructive weapons. So weapons-grade plutonium, which would be illegal for an average person to own, unless you have some kind of license or you get it for scientific purposes, and there are all kinds of restrictions on getting it. I don't know what they are, not worried about it. But I've read enough books recently about radiation and plutonium and weapons and stuff like that to know this is the case. So this idea, if you make guns illegal, only criminals will have them, would be the same thing we would say about weapons-grade plutonium, right? So if you make weapons-grade plutonium illegal, only criminals will have it. And yet we have bothered to make it illegal, you know? It doesn't mean a researcher couldn't have one. Doesn't mean any of that kind of stuff. If you just put it in the context, then you say, yeah, well, I mean, that's true. And yet it probably still is a good idea to criminalize it, because some people would not obtain this thing, and the market would change about this thing if we were to make it illegal. And what this introduces is the reality of where a lot of the pushback on any of these kinds of restrictions comes from. And that is why we make things illegal. That if you make, for instance, a semi-automatic assault weapon illegal, then you are doing it for one of the reasons that we choose to make things illegal. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it, right? And we make things illegal for a lot of reasons. I'll give three of them. One is we need to change some basic function or system in society, that we have some way that we live together, and now we've decided that's not the way we're going to live together, so now it's becoming illegal. So that's what we did with slavery, for instance. It's what we did under Jim Crow when we adopted the Civil Rights Act in 1963, I think it was. Those actions that we took, was it 1964? Now I'm not sure. Anyway, those actions that we took were intended to reshape the society, which is enormous, and you can really only do by passing some kind of law like that. But even on those obvious ones, and don't hear me wrong on this one, hear me to the end of this statement, otherwise somebody could be legitimately and justifiably offended. Even on these obvious ones, that the ones I just mentioned, slavery and Jim Crow segregation in the Old South, and therefore the slavery act, the Civil Rights Act, even on those obvious ones, which, by the way, I'm confident now was adopted in 1964. Thank you to my producer, Daisy. So anyway, even on those very obvious things that we needed to do, ban slavery, make it illegal, and adopt a Civil Rights Act, there are costs. This is why in England people pushed back against the abolition of slavery by talking about the economic consequences to the empire. Well, of course there would be economic consequences. That's why you were enslaving people unjustifiably. And yet it's still the right thing to do to make it illegal. So when you make any kind of fundamental change to a society, anything to do to break a system or a way of thinking, a mental model about the culture, then of course there are going to be some dramatic costs involved with that. It's part of the way we own our society. So we have to be prepared to deal with that when we're going to change a law for that reason. Other laws we adopt because circumstances change, and the laws that we have right now just don't address the situation that's rising before us. For instance, when cloning became a possibility, it's not like you could go back and say, well, in my grandpa's day, we didn't allow cloning. Well, you didn't talk about cloning in your grandpa's day. And so nobody allowed it or disallowed it. And we needed to have some kind of decision about what we were going to do with it, or human experimentation of other kinds, or with artificial intelligence now, or even just with internet shopping. If you buy something in Texas, but the person who sold it to you was in Massachusetts and their servers were in Iowa, which state tax do you pay? You don't know what to do with that until you're actually confronted with it. And in that moment, you adopt new laws. And then the other reason is because there's some ongoing harm that you realize needs to be addressed, and we just can't handle it the way it's being handled right now. Opioids or something like that, designer drugs. When a chemist finds a way to create a drug that does the same thing as something that we've made illegal because it's so destructive, but they make the chemical properties distinct so that it's not covered by the law against the other thing, then suddenly people are being affected by this new designer drug. You know the iterations of this and how they go. Then you have to pass a new law because we have this ongoing harm that needs to be addressed with a new law, and so on. Well, here we are. We want to address guns in the United States. Lo and behold, we get bogged down in all three of those issues, and all three of them carry some pushback and some legitimate difficulties with them. So, for instance, part of the basic system of the United States is our Second Amendment. And I don't mean just basic system because it's in the Constitution or in the Bill of Rights. I mean a basic system because it's pretty fundamental to the way we think about being American citizens. I have the ability to fight back if I need to. I can defend myself. It's just part of our ideology. It's part of how our nation was established. It's built into our system. And what really kills me here, and this will be a different episode. I can't do this one today. what really kills me here, I understand that. I understand how central the Second Amendment is to our thinking about being American citizens and having independence and not having a government that can just roll over us because we can defend ourselves. I understand all of that. What dismays me is how this has become confused with our identification of ourselves as Christians, that somehow we think the Second Amendment is attached to our Christianity. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward for anybody who's studied anything in societies at all, and that's civil religion, that we have made our veneration of our culture, our community, our society, and our government, our political structure, we have made it a religion. And so, you know, what happens is because things like in the Second Amendment and in the Constitution are so fundamental to our values, we think of any action like this as challenging our fundamental values. I understand that, and that's an argument to be had. This is questioning some fundamental values that we hold in our society. But and this, I'm still on the part about us being Christians and why we've confused this political issue with some kind of, as if it's some kind of religious, I can't even say theological. I mean, it's absurd that it would be theological, that it's some kind of religious issue for us. But it's because we have this unwillingness, I hope it's not that, or inability, and maybe it's just that, to separate civil or secular or personal or cultural fundamentals, things that really are basic to our way of understanding ourselves in civil society or in secular society or in our personal values or in our way of relating to the culture and understanding the values of our culture. We're unwilling or unable to separate those kinds of fundamentals from our legitimately religious fundamentals. You know, Jesus rose from the dead. The Holy Spirit empowers those who are in him to live a life that was impossible before we knew him. That in that transformation, we're able to give up thinking our life is the most important thing anymore and recognize that God sent us to lay down our lives for the sake of the very people who might be taking it from us. Those kinds of concepts that are fundamental to our religious values as Christians are not the same thing that's written into the Second Amendment. They're just not. And so it's mystifying to me that we would confuse those two, and yet it happens all the time that, you know, the one way of describing religion is as our way of valuing most deeply. And so whatever we value most deeply suddenly becomes religious to us. You know, we sort of invert the way that relationship works. But it does make sense. If religion is your way of valuing most deeply, and I hope it is, then if you find that what you value most deeply is your arms cabinet, and that has become your religion, or even just a part of your religion, then does anybody else have a bad taste in their mouth just because I'm saying that? Just because it needs to be said in our culture? And you can say, oh, you're exaggerating. Christians don't think that way. They do. I'm around them. I know they do. And something's weird about that. And it is, I think, a confusion of civil religion with actual religion, you know? Anyway, something to think about. Another day, we'll do another discussion on civil religion. I have brought it up before. We've talked about it in some detail in previous episodes, but I'll do another discussion of that in coming days. Okay, that's not a promise. That is a threat. I mean, not a threat either. It's an offer that I hope to fulfill at some point. The point is, because the Second Amendment is so basic to people's thinking about how we're American, and I understand why, we don't, you know, we just think, oh, we can't push back against that at all. But in reality, part of the reason we adopt laws is because we do need to change some basics in our society. And that's scary because it's even with slavery and with the Civil Rights Act, the pushback was enormous. And the costs to the people who were even enacting this change in our society was enormous. So I get that this would not be an easy change, and that's why even the discussion of it rankles so many of our hearts, our thoughts about it. Okay, so anyway. So the second one, I said there are three different reasons that I presented that we adopt laws. One is we want to change something basic about the culture. That makes this a difficult discussion. We want to change the circumstance. I mean, there are changing circumstances in the culture, and we need to address those with laws. That was the second reason I gave. And that's the case here. I mean, look, when the Second Amendment was written, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, there were no assault weapons. This is not complicated. There were no bazookas. There were no tanks. There were no Gatling guns. Gatling guns, 100 years later, there were. But there weren't. Or it wasn't even 100 years. I mean, it was within 80 years. But they weren't when the Second Amendment was written. So does that mean everybody ought to be able to own a bazooka or a tank? Well, of course not. And nobody, I don't hear anybody make the argument that people should own tanks and bazookas. I don't think people are being irrational about that. So it's not necessarily a life-altering discussion just to say maybe assault weapons fit in that category of weapons of war, not things you keep in your closet for an emergency situation or for hunting or something like that. And yeah, I'm sorry you don't get to use an assault weapon at the gun range, but you don't get to use a bazooka either. And we don't let you take a tank out there and shoot at the side of a hill either. And that's a bummer because that would be fun. I mean, come on, let's be honest. That would be fun. In fact, I would drive it over a car. I would drive a tank over a car just for the fun of it if I could, but I can't. And that's okay. So I'm just saying weapons of war are a different category, and we recognize that. There are 10 states who banned them now. Washington State, as I understand it, just banned, just enacted some kind of limitation or a ban on assault weapons or high-capacity magazines, one or the other. And they join 9 other states who've already adopted it. And look, and by the way, there is a thing to keep in mind about the original Bill of Rights. It's not inspired by God. You say everything is inspired by God. Yeah, I mean, that's true in the Job sense. Everything comes as an inspiration from God, of course, but not with the inerrancy or infallibility of Scripture. The Bill of Rights is a brilliant, I think beautiful, and I think defensible and necessary guard against the encroachment of government on our individual life. I love all of that. I can defend all of that. I'm happy with all of that. But the reality is it was written in a circumstance that was segregated. And it's not hard to figure that out. I mean, for African Americans to have no vote or only a certain number or a representation of only, you know, for states to be represented in a way that only counted slaves as 3/5 of a human being. It's not hard to figure out that there were things that were wrong with the Constitution when it was written. That's why the process of amending it was written into it to begin with. Even the people who wrote it knew it would not be sufficient, that you have to make changes sometimes. I get it. Scary, dangerous. It is extremely dangerous and ought to be done with extreme caution. Hence, it's reasonable to have more conversations and not just knee-jerk react to things. That's true, but you do have to have the conversations. And sometimes you have to make the changes. Sometimes you change it by rewording it. Sometimes through courts, you change it by reinterpreting it. But we're always going to have to change it because we do live in changing circumstances. It's part of the reality of our culture. It's true on the conservative side and on the liberal side. Strict constructionists act like this is not true, but it is true. I'm not completely against that. I think there's a defense for strict constructionism that's rational and intelligent. But the reality is we do interpret parts of the Constitution in ways that would not have been in the original author's intent. But because circumstances changed, we had to reconsider just to make sense of it. Anyway, changing circumstances, they are part of the picture. It's going to complicate the conversation no matter what we do. The ongoing harm part, because there is an ongoing, this is the part that we have to deal with most obviously because there is a persistence of mass shootings that involves elevated capacity, these assault weapons or high capacity magazines or whatever, that you can't ignore. It's happening over and over and over again. And I'm not, this is not me saying, oh, you know, we're going to try to philosophize here while we're drowning. I'm not doing that. you know, saying, here's the solution. Now let's think through the solution hard and let's work on it and find. We're, this is about, look, if, let's put it in the comparison like this, if we want to use drowning as an ongoing metaphor. This is about dragging a body out of a creek or a river or some lake somewhere. And you do it once and you say, oh man, what a tragedy that this happened. But if you drag a body out of that river every day of a week and every week of the month and every month of the year and every year, day after week after month after year, you would decide at some point it's time to put up a no swimming sign. Maybe we need to put a guard on duty to keep people from being able to swim here. Yeah, but I know Frank, he can swim here and he can exercise here and it's okay. It's true. He might be able to, but there are so many people drowning. We're allowing it to happen for so long. It's time to do something about it. The persistence of this problem. And we can't pretend it's not there. It's all the time. We just listen to the news each week. Another mass shooting. Another mass shooting. Was it at a school this time? Was it a mall this time? Was it at a bar this time? Was it on the street this time? You know, was it at a college this time? Why do we do trainings at all of our workplaces about what to do when there's a mass shooter? Because it's inductively, we know this is a problem. We need to put up a sign, no more swimming. We need to do something now. So I would love to do one more objection. I don't want to use up too much time. So I'll run through this one quickly to get to the conclusion. But one more objection, which is it's about mental health. It's true. It is about mental health. There is a lot of this about mental health. And if you define mental health as everything that's involved about being successfully acclimated or assimilated into society, then it's true prima facie that it's that all of these perpetrators have a mental health issue, obviously. But it's also the case that some of these perpetrators do have a legitimate mental health issue that could have been addressed. And if it had been, may have prevented some of these incidents. Fine, I'll just grant you that. I'm not making that argument. I'm just repeating the argument that I've heard from others. And I'll say, yeah, that's true. And if we'd had therapy, if we'd had redirection for some people, if there'd been restraint for some people, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to put you in a hospital somewhere. Okay, fine. If we had to do all of that, maybe it actually would have helped. But there is something false about this also. Because addressing the mental health issue in no way limits the fact that we could also address the capacity issue, the weapons issue, in these instances. And in fact, as long as 2,500 years ago, Plato addressed this question, including the question of mental health, meaning in his discussion of justice in the Republic, Plato talks about using, and this is Socrates, you know, Plato's using Socrates' arguments, his teacher's arguments. And he says, we'll define justice as returning to every man his due, you know, giving to every man his due. So if you were to borrow something from someone, justice is giving it back to them. If somebody owns something and they don't have it right now, justice is giving it to them, right? And so what Socrates, using his method, which is brilliant, is always just to ask a question that undermines that answer. And his question that undermined that answer, one of his questions that undermined that answer was to say, okay, so you borrowed a weapon from your neighbor. And your neighbor now, in a state out of their mind, they want to kill you. And it's because they're drunk or because they're, you know, whatever. Something's gone wrong and they want to kill you. And they come back to you and they knock on their door and they say, that's my weapon. I want my weapon back. Why do you want your weapon back now? I mean, I just borrowed it from you. Well, I'm planning on killing you. Well, the just thing to do is to give them back their weapon. Of course not. That's not the just thing to do. And it makes sense here to say that even if the Second Amendment is defended in its most arduous format or its most arduous interpretation, it is also the case that even under the Second Amendment, on this acknowledgement that mental health could be an issue with some people who are involved in this, defining it one way or the other, it might make sense not to give that person a weapon or allow them to have a weapon. And it might make sense to write that into the law and how we practice things in our society. And there are a variety of ways you can do that. But I'm just saying it's not off the table to talk about just because of this. Okay, another aspect of this one about mental health is it's true that something, so, wow, I do need to take more time than I can probably take in this episode. I'm going to skip through this one really quickly, but it's not a quick one. This would be a whole episode by itself, and maybe we'll have to do it as a whole episode by itself. But it is true that something is wrong with our minds because we inherently fear people who look different than we do, or they behave differently in our culture than we do. And it's true that people who are who have a mental vulnerability in some ways can be exaggerated or manipulated about that fear of those who are different from them. I've seen it happen. I'm not making a case from statistics or studies. I just know it's the case that it happens, that sometimes people who are vulnerable in their minds, in their mindset, can follow an ideology that's harmful, including xenophobia, including racism, on either side. And it does happen that that people fall into this. And my experience with hate groups includes the fact that mentally vulnerable people can get pulled into a hateful ideology, just like anybody else can be pulled into a hateful ideology. All of that's true. What's false is this. I mean, what makes this objection false? Well, it's just about mental health. The fact that race and xenophobia have been a part of some mass shootings, that's obvious. El Paso, you can't argue about it. That's why the guy went to El Paso and participated in that shooting in the grocery store there. Allen, maybe it's being researched. As I'm speaking, it's still being researched and people are figuring it out, but it seems like it was likely the motivation for what was going on there. That does mean we should be identifying the proliferation of fear-mongering and race-baiting. We should be doing this. We should be participating in limiting that. We should recognize what's going on in our society that makes it okay to denigrate immigrants, to denigrate people who are not even immigrants but just look like they had some ancestor that came from somewhere other than Sweden or England. We should be questioning that. Okay, I got to move on. But all of that in no way means that we shouldn't be addressing the question of what we do to limit access to weapons at the same time that we're talking about that. The idea that more weapons, last one I'll present here, creates a safer society, that it makes criminals think twice. I'll just put it this way. We're not trying to recreate the Wild West. I wish I had time to go into it. The judge, when I was being selected on a jury one time, spent his whole time with the jury just making that point. Thank you so much for your service. This allows us to make decisions in our society, to enforce laws in our society, using civil means instead of with guns on the street. And yet I get the distinct idea from a lot of people that we'd like to see a return to just, you know, justice by guns on the street. The most skilled person with a gun should not be the arbiter of civil power in a civilized society. That's not the way a civilized society is supposed to function. That's a Nietzschean nightmare, and we don't want that. So here's where I'm going. This is where I've tried to go, that is. Ultimately, in one way, I agree guns are not the problem. But it is. I think this is a serious problem, and I think it's central to one of our problems. It's really our mentality about guns that is the problem. That thinking that having guns makes us safe and strong and prepared. I'm not, again, if you heard the rest of the discussion, you know I'm not disparaging the fact that they can have their use. But not everyone should think about it the same way I do. I know there are different responsibilities and obligations for different people. I'm thankful for a police officer who shows up and is able to stop a killer. I'm grateful for that. But aside from all the gifts for guns I've had, I mentioned to you that I've purchased one gun, an XDS, 45 caliber, whatever, semi-automatic, semi-automatic pistol. Really nice gun. You know why I bought it? Because everybody was getting conceal and carry licenses. Now I think they're CCPs or LTCs or whatever people call them. And I thought, well, I'm going to get me one of those. But then it didn't take me but just a few minutes. I sat down and thought to myself, is that who I think I'm called to be in our culture? Do I want to be able to charge in between a killer and his victim? I do. Do I want to do it in a way that'll keep them from getting to their victim? I do. And I know myself. I've known myself for 60 years, and I think I would. Nobody knows until they get in that situation. But what's incomprehensible to me is a pastor who would say to his congregation, everybody bring guns, so if the government tells us we can't meet, but if we're not masked, then we can stop them at the door. That's incomprehensible to me for a Christian to consider as a reasonable statement. That was something that happened. It's incomprehensible to me that a pastor would, you know, seeing some drummed up, and by the way, artificial internet image of migrants lined up at the border, thousands of migrants, saying that's why there's a Second Amendment. Everyone with a gun, meet them at the border. That's incomprehensible to me that a Christian, much less a Christian leader, would say that's the response that we ought to have. Something in our mindset about guns does need to change. At some point, we have to decide again that the power in our society is in ideas and ballots and respect and self-restraint and not simply in force. We have a better way of valuing as believers. And to the extent that we want our values reflected in our society, we should pray for our society to find a better way of valuing. May we do better. May we do better soon. May we do better now.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.